So I think we had a sort of some unfinished business from the morning discussion regarding these frictionless hard spheres, I guess.
Yeah, okay, so I was just referring to this paper. So I think the claim is clear from the title. What they are doing is that they are doing MD simulations of frictionless hard sphere. Hard spheres mean essentially they have a Hertzian contact, and they will look at a limit where the stiffness parameter is very large. So it's extremely stiff Hertzian spheres. And the way the damping is introduced in the system is by having some kind of viscous forces when particles come into close contact in the range of the Hertz contact, with some parameter here, zeta, which in fact is related to the resulting restitution of coefficient. That's something you can get simply by looking at one collision and by asking how much energy has been dissipated. And when you do that, essentially the one typical value that will come up is this value of 0.98, which corresponds to an extremely low coefficient of restitution. But the whole study is done using varying these parameters zeta, and therefore varying the coefficient of restitution from something which is in the 10 minus 3 to something which is as high as 0.87. And so essentially, I think the main thing is that, so I is just so the simulations are done in 3D. I is just gamma dot, and then there is square root of m over the particle size and the pressure. And of course, as you have, because of dimensional analysis, everything can be rescaled according to this parameter. And what you see here is that essentially you can manage to have flows. So if you take the limit, you fix pressure, and now you take the limit of a very, so imagine you fix pressure and you go to a low gamma dot, you would follow this curve that way, and you arrive at packing fraction, which is of the order of 0.64. In fact, the actual measurement of the limit packing fraction here is quite delicate. And that's what comes out from this paper, because you need not only to find a limit of the low strain rate, but you need also to find a limit of large system sizes. And there are large fluctuations of the density which come in when you have system sizes which are finite. In the end, they arrive at this value for the limit packing fraction, which is actually close within a numerical accuracy to the random closed packing limit. So that's why the claim that there is no dilatancy. They actually have also tried to produce granular packs by isotropic compression. And using isotropic compression, they managed, in fact, to reach packing fraction which were of the order of 0.639, and which means, in fact, that when they start to shear the system, there is, in fact, a slight compression instead of dilatancy, and before the system reaches the steady state. Okay, so that's...
When they did this compression,
yeah.
I mean, for example, if you just try doing that with a sand pack, you know that you're not going to do a very good job, but if you vibrate, small amplitude vibration, you can do a whole lot better.
That's right, but the random closed packing is 0.64, right? It's a figure which is known.
And I understand that you're not there anymore. So this packing fraction they get when they take the strain rate to zero.
Right.
So
that wasn't the issue.
So this is the issue. Yeah. This is the issue. The issue is where you have a singularity in the stress. Right? So a singularity, you take pressure. Pressure is 1 over I square. Okay, the point is that what we plot, when you look at granular system, what you plot is, for example, in a plot which was shown as a function of packing fraction, the plot would be sigma versus gamma dot square, or pressure versus gamma dot square modulo some prefactors, right? And the point is that this should diverge at one packing fraction. Right? If you take the inverse of that, you just have a strain rate, and I is just... So again, the question is, what is the packing fraction when the limit when I goes to zero? That is the question. Of course, if you have...
So what is being shown in this graph is...
Well, this is the Well, okay, if you, you revert to the graph.
No, just keep it as it is.
Yes.
What is the density that's shown? It's jam density.
This is the density? No, this is the steady state, the density measure in the steady state flow.
I mean, there is information that there is flow.
Right. I here.
Sorry.
What you prescribe is this.
Okay.
The only what you prescribe is this, and you have a one-to-one relation between this parameter and the density because of dimensional invariance of the Hartzfeld problem. So the point is that obviously the density will depend on this parameter. Obviously, I mean, at different flow rates, you reach different density. Different ratios between gamma dot and square root of p, you have different density, that's clear. The question is, what is the limit here? What is the highest limit of packing fraction that you can reach? And this is just what you write when, I mean, this is just random.
So how can you reconcile this result with the thing that we have this morning?
My viewpoint is here, is that what we had done before, that was no older thing, we looked at the forces. What we can do, you can take a flow and you measure the particle forces. And that's something you measure instantaneously. You can measure the stress or the forces. And you also know what is the momentum transfer, which is the one you would get in kinetic theory. So you can construct a tensor, which is the tensor corresponding to the exchange of momentum due to the binary collisions. In a numerical simulation, you have access to all this information. So what we did is that we measured the forces, the true force, the actual forces, and we also measured the binary collision component of the forces. What we find is that, in fact, when you go to high packing fraction, at some point we'll have to go through pathways where you no longer have binary collision, when you start to have multiple collisions, and the trace of the multiple collision that there are forces between grains, which are no longer just don't amount only to the one that you have during a collisions occurring at the zero over a zero time interval. And so the point is that now if you look at, okay, that's the packing fraction, alpha is the coefficient of restitution. What we looked at this morning were high coefficient of restitutions here. And in fact, if you restrict yourself to binary collisional flows, then you do have a strong dependence, I mean, of how far you can go in packing fraction with the coefficient of restitution. So I think that might be more an effect of the coefficient, the fact that there is a constraint that we want to look at binary collisional flows rather than flows intrinsical.
So can you remind us what system this is? Just because it goes to 0.8 something packing.
Okay, sorry. This is a 2D system with different particle sizes, so that's why the limit packing fraction is different. The point is that you...
In terms of what Kumaran had, so if I sort of take the set of curves where he has sort of jamming at different densities for different strain gaps, if I take some constant stress and cut, I would basically get the same figure as you have, right? Because if I then plot the strain rate, so for the higher the strain rate,
I think
lower will be the packing fraction.
I think there are two issues. One is how you extrapolate to low gamma dots. How do you find the limit packing fraction? What we saw this morning was it was the inverse of that. It was something like a strain rate. Yes, I think if I'm correct, it was a parameter which was something like the inverse of this, or this, or the square root of that.
Probably, it's another collision frequency.
Right.
Frequency
and we saw that depending on E, when E is near one, it was like this, and then we have something like that. The question is how you extrapolate, in particular from this data, the point where it's zero is zero. That's one. And this must involve a scaling, which involves both, of course, your parameters, the loss, the gamma dot going to zero limit, and the system size, because system size effects introduce large fluctuations.
Your plot this morning was on a linear y-axis, no? And so basically, the critique is that we should look it on the log axis, and then you would see that perhaps the spending over
exactly
makes
exactly
the curve jump.
Exactly. That's one thing. But then there are issues of system size. You know, how do you extrapolate? Okay, so that might be a question. The next question which I'm raising here, which I don't know, but that's another question, is the fact that you're looking at event-driven dynamics versus molecular dynamics or contact dynamics. That might also play a role, because at some point the system needs to go through pathways where you have multiple contacts, right? And the question is whether event-driven might limit, in fact, the type of trajectories that your system used to deform.
Okay. You want me to?
Yeah, if you have something quick.
I'll say it needs a longer discussion, but the only thing I would say is that in contact dynamic simulations, you're using a finite time step.
Mm-hmm.
And all collisions within that time step are supposed to be simultaneous contacts.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you use a hard particle system, you need to reduce that time step proportional to the inverse of the collision frequency.
Uh-huh.
As the collision frequency keeps increasing, you're going to get more and more particles colliding within a fixed time step.
It's all MD simulations. All MD simulations or contact dynamic simulations must have a finite time step. That's obvious. Now, what you can, let me answer that. Just the only thing you can do is you scale down your time step and you check whether you find the same result. You do a simulation after, with one time step.
So what you identify as clusters is going to depend upon what time step you use. And,
no.
We should exchange data on that.
Yes, but no, this is not depending on the time step. No.
Because in a hard particle system, when the collision time is zero, if you have a chain of particles, they are not in mechanical equilibrium. You need at least four contacts per particle to be in mechanical equilibrium. Okay, so you cannot have a simultaneous contact network which consists of a chain of particles and linear contact.
But you're never at equilibrium because particles have some inertia, they have a momentum.
So, but how do you get multiple particles to be in contact simultaneously when the collision time is zero?
I don't understand this claim that the collision time is zero. You have gravitational collapse. Gravitational collapse means you can form sustained contact.
This is a shear steady state system.
Yes.
It's not like a particle is bouncing onto a surface.
Yes. So, do you mean that as soon as you have shared system, you have a zero probability of forming sustained contact?
Okay, so Sri had asked Dan and me to talk about models and methods, and not just to talk about them, but to raise questions about them. And as an example of the sort of question one might ask, he gave me an example. What is it that we want, and how do we get it? To which Walter Kobe remarked on the great generality of these questions that had just been raised. So we're supposed to be raising questions, but actually, I'm going to disobey and try to answer instead of ask. So in particular, I'm going to tell, I don't know, it's not quite perfectly centered, but I think that you can read well enough. Yes, we can. I'm going to talk about ways that you can do realistic modeling of specific systems and try to understand detailed mechanisms that that apply. And I'm going to concentrate what I say about descriptions of metallic glass using electronic structure approaches. And then Dan is going to talk about more generic and universal approaches to addressing some of these questions. I plan to give sort of a historical view of the development of models and methods over time. And From my perspective, a good point to start is this seminal work of Nagel and Tock, which proposed an electronic structure-based mechanism for stabilizing a metallic glass. And the first thing they pointed out was that if you look at the structure factor of a metallic glass, it will have peaks. So here is S of Q plotted as a function of Q, and here is the pronounced first peak in the structure factor, and of course it will oscillate later on. And on the same plot, they indicate where twice the Fermi vector would be for a monovalent metal. Twice the Fermi vector would be right here. For a divalent metal, twice the Fermi vector would be there. And actually, the best glass-forming systems, they tend to put their Fermi vector more or less there. And they pointed this out and addressed a possible mechanism. And the mechanism they suggest involves the electronic density of states. So here is electronic density of states. Density is a function of energy. The solid black parabola is the classic free electron parabola. The dashed lines are generic densities of states for structures which have structure factors that look like this. Basically, if you have a peak in the structure factor, then you should expect to have a pseudo gap in the density of states corresponding to that peak. The way to understand this qualitatively is make an analogy with a crystal where the peak in the structure factor would be like a Bragg peak. And then you know that if you have Bragg peaks in a structure, the electrons inside that crystal will undergo diffraction, and it's the diffraction of internal electrons that gives rise to gaps and other singularities in the density of states. So that's the origin of this gap, or so-called pseudo gap, in the density of states. And the neat thing about the pseudo gap in the density of states is that the states that lie below the pseudo gap in energy, by and large, their energies have dropped. So there are more states at low energy because of the pseudo gap. And above the pseudo gap, there's an extra density of states at higher energy. Of course, if you place your Fermi level right in the middle of the pseudo gap, then the occupied states have their energies reduced, and the empty states are the ones whose energy went up. So this is, in fact, a very universal mechanism for stabilizing nearly free electron compounds. It applies not only to glasses, but also to crystals. But the point is that the competing crystal phases for many of these metallic glasses, their Bragg peaks are not at this wave vector, but they're off here, or they're somewhere else. And so this pseudo-gap stabilization method then is appropriate for the stabilization of the glassy state. And that idea was pursued further in a much more rigorous fashion by Jürgen Höffner, who really pioneered an ab initio approach to the derivation of interatomic interactions. The idea is that we know that the density functional theory, total energy, should be an accurate description of the cohesion of a bulk solid, but calculating the density functional theory energy is a challenging task. And Höffner showed how it could be done perturbatively by carrying out basically a Taylor series of the total energy in the strength of the pseudo potential that describes the interaction of the atoms with the conduction electrons or valence electrons. And so here is that perturbation theory. We start with the quantity that we're expanding. And then I've written down for you the first two terms in the perturbation expansion. This is basically the constant term that's independent of the atoms that are present. And in fact, it's worth understanding this term right here. There is a certain cohesive energy you have simply for having bulk matter at a certain density. And that cohesion arises primarily from the reduction in kinetic energy of electrons. When you bring individual atoms close together, the electrons delocalize, the kinetic energy drops, and you gain a great deal of stability. And in fact, this is by far the dominant term in the total energy. And if you want to understand what is the density of a bulk solid, really this is the main thing that you need to concern yourself with. And the remarkable thing about it is it's independent of the structure. So, you know, what is the cohesive energy of face-centered cubic aluminum compared with a hypothetical body-centered cubic aluminum? Their cohesive energies are almost the same. And so everything that determines the actual structure is just a very small correction to this most important term. Yes.
Metallic systems, this statement is true.
And this is true for metallic systems in particular. It's most true for those that are best described as perturbations away from a nearly free electron system. So aluminum alloys, alkali metals, alkali earths, things with loosely bound outer shell electrons. Then there is no first order term in this series expansion, but there is a second order term. So this is second order in the strength of the pseudo potential. It basically describes the fact that when you place an atom into an electron gas, it will set up a ringing oscillation in the electron gas density. And then when you place a second atom into that electron gas that now has an oscillating density, there will be preferred positions for the second atom. And that, of course, will come at second order in the strength of the pseudo potential. And that is formally the origin of the pair potential. So this is the dominant structure-dependent term that will say, tell you that aluminum wants to be face-centered cubic instead of body-centered cubic. It's also worth noting that very generically, the form of this function is, roughly speaking, an oscillation, and it's an oscillation whose spatial frequency is twice the Fermi wave number. It also falls off in space with a certain power law. These are the so-called Friedel oscillations. Okay, and I just want to show you the pair potentials that Hofner calculated. He looked at a whole series of different nearly free electron-like glass-forming compounds, and in particular, his 1980 paper concentrated on calcium-based compounds. So, for example, a calcium-magnesium glass. He has derived interatomic potentials. And, of course, for a binary alloy, there will be three potentials. So the top slide here gives calcium-calcium, calcium-magnesium, and magnesium-magnesium. The slides are kind of busy, so I drew on top of them just to show you that this curve here is the potential. And you can see, for example, that the first minimum of the calcium-calcium potential is at a larger radius than the first minimum of calcium-magnesium, and magnesium-magnesium is at the smallest radius, consistent with our notion of the relative atomic sizes of the atoms calcium and magnesium. So those are the oscillating parts of the pair potentials. Then I also highlighted for you G of R, which is the pair distribution function obtained by molecular dynamics simulations using these potentials. And it's worth noting that wherever the pair correlation function has gone above 1, this is 1 on the limiting value of G of R, wherever G of R exceeds 1, the pair potential is negative. And you see that those oscillations are very beautifully exactly out of phase with one another. And that's just what's required in order to have this pair potential stabilize this particular glassy structure, because you get energy benefits, that is negative energies, where you have enhanced correlation strength. And in fact, this beautiful matching of the oscillating pair correlation function with the oscillations of the pair potential. That is just a real space equivalent of the Nagel-Tok law that says 2kf, which remember is the frequency of the oscillation of the pair potential, should match up with the maximum of the structure factor, Q maximum, which describes, of course, the oscillations of the pair correlation function. Yeah?
Two things. This works best for nearly free electron
correct.
Metals.
Yes.
And,
it has been.
Also for alloys, I believe that you look at alloys, you see short range order that parallels the Fidel oscillation.
You can see chemical order as well, yes.
Alloys as well for the same reason.
Yes, absolutely.
Any of the tight binding things, all that's wrong?
No. So, first of all, what I described was Hofner's work, but Moriarty has extended this perturbation method to treat transition metals. And so he has something he calls the generalized perturbation theory that incorporates the D bands and tight binding description of transition metals. So notice that I've added on the higher order terms here. You do get, in some cases, important 3 and 4 body terms when you include the transition metals. In particular, when you have transition metal neighbors, you can have many body terms being important. And then, does this sort of complicate the matching of potentials to correlation functions? Yeah, it does complicate it. I mean, already here, we have a binary alloy. And life can get worse with more components or more complex systems.
Having those long-range oscillatory tails and empirical potentials.
It does fall off. I guess the Friedel actually would have it fall off like 1/r³, which is problematic as far as summing things in three dimensions goes. I've done a lot of work with potentials like this, and what I generally do is actually right about the end of this picture, I just cut it off. So I've applied this, in fact, using potentials developed with Moriarty to studies of quasicrystals, and we do find important features in not only the second minimum, but even the third minimum of the potential often contains some important information. So yeah, there it's longer range than you might like, but it's still, you can truncate it and get an order n computational method. Yeah?
I have a question going back to the first term, because
the volume term,
the volume term between the density fluctuations in the system might couple with this term.
Yes, absolutely.
And isn't that partly responsible for these fluctuations?
There's a hidden difficulty that I didn't quite mention, which is that the pair potential, of course, it oscillates with the Fermi wave vector. Well, what is the Fermi wave vector? The Fermi wave vector is determined by the density of electrons. And so, in fact, V2 is itself a function of the volume. And if you want to do a complete relaxation, including unit cell, then you need to use the proper volume-dependent pair potentials in order to do this. So there are aspects of this decomposition that are annoying when you want to do molecular dynamics simulations. But this is, the payoff is that you're doing something a little closer to reality. And in particular, if you're accustomed to using, say, Leonard Jones potentials to do simulations, very often you will use the Leonard Jones potential to set the volume, right? So the fluctuations of the volume will correspond to oscillations around the minimum of the Leonard Jones potential. But really, I think the Leonard Jones potential should properly be thought of as V2, and you need an additional term to set the volume. That really you're asking the Leonard Jones potential to do too much. to simultaneously determine the volume and the structure at that volume.
The primary consequence of this is the Poisson ratio.
So yes, yeah, absolutely.
The volume term increases the Poisson ratio. If you have just Leonard Jones, then Poisson ratio is 0.25, too low.
Yeah. I mean, in particular, if you have only a pair potential, then these Cauchy ratios are set at a particular value, which is not the correct value for most structures.
What is the relevant value of P for good metals?
Let's see. I've done quite a bit of work actually fitting this type of form plus. one of those to first principles data. And I usually find that what it gives the best fit to a full first principles calculation is around P of 5 or 7, around in that range.
Yeah, this is, to have the data you would and need to do sort of electronic structure calculations for systems that large.
No. So the interatomic potential should be transferable to any structure. Let's agree that we'll hold the volume fixed. So any structure at the fixed volume should have the same V2, and any deviation should be attributed to the higher order terms.
The structure will determine the interactions
I would say that's a little bit of a philosophical question, but that's exactly contrary to my personal point of view. I mean, we have certain atomic species. The way in which they are going to interact is determined once you point out the spots on the periodic table you're choosing from. And then your job, our job as simulators, is to figure out what it is those atoms want to do.
I can sort of vary the state point at which I look at the system and have very different structures which are sampled in equilibrium. And in each case, I can try to do this exercise of picking the best.
Right. And if you use a very small and particular sample of structures, you will get a different best fit to this form than if you use a different very small sample. On the other hand, you can use a large set of small systems in order to, hopefully get representative. Let's remember that this is not the exact functional form. And so, in any case, our fitting will be imperfect. And you just try to sort of average out over what you believe is a representative set of structures.
The only point is, forget about sort of disordered structures for the time being. Right?
Yeah.
If I just take different periodic structures.
Yeah. Let me remind you that in this derivation right here, no structural information has been put in. So first, John Moriarty will calculate for you this term and that term. He'll send it to you, and then you will say, I want to compare this structure and that structure. So he knows nothing about the structure when he calculates this term. When I do empirical fits to this thing, then I do put in particular structures. But the real ab initio derivation of the pair potential is completely transferable.
Yeah,
it's done using perturbation theory about a free electron gas. So you perturb the free electron gas using the electron-ion interaction potential, which is a property of the atom alone and
But
it comes in later when you evaluate the sum, then the particular lattice structure will alter what the value of the sum is, but the lattice structure does not alter that function V2.
Well, so the P-dependent structure, the free for perfect sphere, And if it is slightly distorted, it becomes larger. But KF does not, Fermi volume does not depend on the structure very much. So
right.
That was the point, right?
Yeah, so that's an example of that. Yeah, Yes.
How much does this depend on the pseudo potential zero?
Well, of course, you do get slightly different answers depending on the pseudo potentials used. Yeah. So these derivations are done in certain approximations. First of all, they are electronic density functional theory. So in particular, they use the local density approximation. And then in addition, they are a perturbation theory in the strength of the pseudo potential. And so different pseudo potentials will give rise to slightly different functional forms.
So at least superficially, this looks a lot like an EAM potential, other than the fact that, I guess, in the EAM potential, the first function is chosen.
EAM potential, this quantity is itself a structure-dependent function.
Right, but it's trying to get a local approximation of the density.
Yes, that's correct.
And then usually your pair potential is rather short.
Yes. And so in speaking of the EAM potential, I just wanted to conclude with this slide, which is if pair potentials aren't good enough for you, if you want a greater degree of realism, then what will you do? And the first thing that people like to do is go to an embedded atom type potential, which, as Michael just pointed out, can be thought of roughly in the terms of this formula here, where your volume energy, instead of being just a function of the volume, it's instead a function of the local electron density at each atom. So the embedded atom form is that you have a function of electron density, and the electron density itself is a function of atomic positions. And then in addition, you have a conventional pair potential.
So yeah. The GFRs that we're showing, the next slide, conventional wisdom in dense liquids is that the details of the wiggles and bumps and the attractive part are not very strongly determining the GFR that we have, right?
Well, it's true that even if you had, say, Leonard Jones with just a single minimum, your G of R would still oscillate. So that's true. And there can, in fact, be some degree of incompatibility between the oscillations set up by the strong first minimum of the potential can somehow sometimes be a little bit incompatible with the later wiggles, and that will usually tend to result in reduced stability. But one other thing that we do know from liquid state theory is that the large R limit is going to be precisely V minus V of R over KT. That is the large R limit even for a dense liquid. But you have to go to quite large R to reach that point.
Now the particular illustration that you have there, obviously it's a special case in some sense because supposed to be one which is conducive to forming metallic
gases,
right?
Yes.
But I just want to understand in terms of the relationship between the pair potential and the GFR, what is the special condition? One is what you said, which is, is there a simple way of
I don't know of a simple. So you're asking about, say, if you were to truncate the potential at this point, you want to know what would G of R have looked like in that case, and how close would it be to the G of R we actually see. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer in this case. But what I can say is that when you look at structures that are being stabilized in this mechanism, you usually see matching of this quality.
Hypothetically, if I do the truncation, I would have a GFR which would have these oscillations that I see, and then I'm adding on a piece of the potential. so that the minima in this oscillatory potential match where the geothermal peaks are.
Yeah. I mean, you could perhaps even use that as a criterion for, you might be able to use that as a criterion for designing potentials that will stabilize a particular type of structure. You know, to if you want to get a double minimum potential, this is a way to choose a an auspicious position for your second minimum.
Isn't it exactly what you have written? I mean, that Q max is determined by the surface of the structure.
Well, this is really a statement about the asymptotic behavior.
No, but I'm asking, when is it true?
Well, it's true when the electronic density is such that 2k.
Yeah, it's true when you're getting pseudo gap stabilization, but how to know when that's going to happen is a harder problem.
So just for the record, yeah. I think this competes with my statement for general application.
Uh-huh. Okay. So let's see. One other thing I wanted to say about embedded atom type potentials is. They're very difficult to obtain, even for a single species. There is no universal agreement about what is a good embedded atom potential, and trying to fit it to experimental data or first principles data, which is what people try to do. The fitting procedure is horrendous and often does not converge. So embedded atom type potentials are really hard to get hold of, but luckily, there are people in this world who love making them, and they have agreed to put their best work for public access at this site. So NIST, you know, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, is collecting a set of high-quality interatomic potentials. So they mostly have pure elements and binaries. I heard it said 2 years ago that there is no acceptable ternary embedded atom potential. But on the other hand, I did see a few of them on this website recently. So maybe things have changed. Or maybe you'd better avoid those like the plague. Okay, and then finally, if you really want to go beyond pair potentials and embedded atom type, then do what I'm doing, which is the full ab initio calculations, but just realize that what you gain in accuracy and transferability, you lose in computational efficiency. And so, as I mentioned last week, you can, if you want to do molecular dynamics, you're going to be limited to system sizes of a couple hundred atoms. And you will be limited to timescales of tens of picoseconds. Okay, so I think next up is Dan.
Thanks. So you set things up very nicely in many ways, but the part I was intrigued with most was, right?
Yep.
Since you were talking about realistic systems, I guess I'm talking about the unrealistic systems. I was happy to see that you gave me a better adjective, so I'll be talking about the universal systems. Right, and okay, so just to start off in the spirit of managing expectations, I'd like to thank Shri for asking me to do this. I think the objective is to stimulate discussion, and I think he asked me to talk because he knew that I would provoke discussion. If nothing else, through my ignorance on the topic, I want to make it clear that this is not a topic that I work on. So I'll be giving a talk more in the spirit that Shri had mentioned in terms of asking questions. And if really difficult questions come up, I'll deflect them back to you. The one thing where Mike and I overlap exactly is we are both focusing on atomic simulation of metallic glasses. Now, this community is covering simulations in a broad range of materials. And so I want to make this clear from the start, because the things that you do and the ways you would do it may be different than what some of you are used to doing because of the fact that we're looking at so many different systems. So what I wanted to do is just to spend a minute to introduce metallic glasses to those who may be spending their time modeling other sorts of systems. And again, these are my views taken from experimental observation, from some of my modeling work, and from reading the literature. But this is the way that I would characterize metallic systems. So first of all, the interatomic potentials need to have an attractive component. If you're looking at just repulsive potentials, I think you stand a potential of missing some very important features that eventually come out in metallic glasses. Especially metallic glasses are known to show a very significant chemical short-range ordering and also a significant degree of medium-range ordering as well. And sometimes it's very hard to generate that in simulations where you don't have an atomic potential. I say roughly spherical only in the sense that the potentials, in the spirit of what Mike had been talking, are the bonding is largely non-directional. Now, of course, especially when you start to get transition metals involved, you can get hybridization of some of the bonding. And so there is usually some component of covalent bonding and even, in some cases, ionic bonding. But in general, the bonding can be thought of as being mostly non-directional. Another important thing is that in terms of size distributions for the constituent species, metallic glasses are characterized as bidispersed, tridispersed, or quaddispersed. I don't know if that's the right word. And so monodispersed, of course, metallic glasses can be produced in the elemental form, but only under very, very special conditions, usually vapor deposition or, in some cases, electrodeposition. But in terms of melt quenching, metallic glasses are always alloys of two or more elements. And if you deconvolve that to look at the number of different sizes, we've done this now for hundreds and hundreds of different glasses, and we haven't found any yet with more than four different atomic sizes. And when I give my talk at the workshop next week, I'll go into some detail about why there are typically no more than four different atomic sizes in metallic glasses. And then also we find that there is a strong preference for a small number of relative atomic sizes, and we've again looked at hundreds or thousands of different metallic glasses, and again I'll show some of this in my talk next week, but it's a very, very strong preference for specific sizes, and the physical feature that motivates this is the desire of the system to adopt local and global efficient atomic packing. So those are the main important things. This is actually a rather simple thing to modify in simulations, and these are the things that come out of a simulation. But in terms of setting the approach, setting things up to model the system, those are probably the important things that I would propose are important to keep in mind if the objective is to model metallic glass systems. Okay, so same two questions. What do we want and how will we get there? In the spirit of Mike's talk, I'll give one specific view, my view of what I think would be valuable to do. And then in terms of how we get there, that's where it'll be more of a democratic discussion. And so what I would like to propose as a useful activity for atomic simulations is to explore the influence of chemical and topological contributions to metallic glass stability, and I introduced this as a complement to what Mike talked about, where his work is focused on the detailed study, a very detailed study using realistic potentials in a few carefully selected systems. And I would propose that as an important complement to that, there are many insights that are probably only going to be achieved by looking at trends that become apparent when you look at systematic study of many different systems. And so this is where I think the empirical potentials, I think, have a real role to play because we can vary things quickly and look for trends across many different systems. And when I say many different systems, I'll put a face on that on the next chart. So specifically, systematically vary topology and chemistry. I say that this approach has largely not been undertaken. I'm aware of only one paper that's done that, and I show this here. It was a simple MD study that came out. Shimono and Onodera, Script and Materialia, 2001. I can put it on the wiki site if you'd like.
So can you be a bit more specific? Like, so Evan Ma had done some things where they looked at, I think, the copper zirconium system in various compositions. But is that not what you're thinking of?
So he used a combination of ab initio and molecular dynamics.
Right, so there, yeah. So EAM potentials, but you're thinking about experimental.
I might not be familiar with the details of what you've just mentioned. I know some of Evan Ma's earlier work, and they use a combination of ab initio calculations, embedded atom methods, and molecular dynamics. And they bring them all together. And so since part of it is ab initio, I'm not considering it as part of this.
I think the crucial point here is that what they did was the detailed study of a specific system.
Yeah.
Whereas the spirit here is to, you know, probably introduce maybe a parameterized potential or something that doesn't actually describe any system, but still can lead to general conclusions.
Yeah, so another piece of work that Evan Ma and Howard Sheng had done is using the same sort of approach was in nickel phosphorus. So he's done it in a couple of different systems, but it's a very detailed study. And what I'm talking about is something much more general. So just to make it a little bit clearer, we've just finished writing a paper on assessment of binary metallic glasses. And this shows all of the different elements that we have found going through the literature, only in binary glasses. And so you can see we cover 60 different elements. That's most of the metals. And so if you're going to start to develop some of these potentials, as Mike was talking about, it's a huge, huge task. And so we're looking for something that's much simpler, where we can vary some simple parameters, a relative size and relative potential bond energy. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But you want to be able to do it in a way that's simple enough so that you can traverse a significant amount of the periodic table. And other people have done some very nice work as well. Mo Li has done... Mo's done some very nice work. I show this here. Jalali and Lee, FISREV B, 2005. And Mo will be happy to give this paper to you. I've got it as well. But in this case, he looked at the influence of relative atomic size and relative atomic composition. But this was all in hard sphere systems with no attractive potentials. He still sees some interesting agreement with things that are have been proposed for metallic glasses and other systems, but you know, if you don't look at both the chemistry and the topology, I think you give up some robustness in terms of the sorts of things. So when I say that this approach has largely not been undertaken, I'm talking about pseudopotentials that systematically vary the relative strength between the atomic bonds and the relative size between the species.
Excuse me, I don't quite get your message. I mean, if you cool it quickly enough, even a one-component system is a glass form.
Right.
So what is it given here that you take an arbitrary two-component glass form as a separate composition, and then you put it on your convex transparency? I mean, does it need the reality of certain cooling rates so that you say, now this is a good glass form? Or what is your criteria, basically?
Okay. So I'll jump ahead just a little bit. The way that I think of it is the two most important things that are worth defining in the potentials you use are the relative sizes and the relative depth of the well, if you want to think about it. So if we think of sizes to begin with, there's a question of whether the sizes should be additive or non-additive.
Well, I think the question is a little different. It's as a person in the glasses community, how do you decide whether something's a glass form? Because if you quench anything quick enough, it's a glass
form. Okay. Right. Okay. So, this shows, I suppose, a particular bias. If you want to make an an elemental metallic glass, the only way that I know you can do that reliably is through vapor deposition. And of course you can do that, but when we talk about the metallic glass community and the richness of alloys and applications and properties that you get, I'm trying to think now. I can only think of one case where vapor deposition is important. But in most cases, it's by quenching from the liquid. In that case, that limits your range of accessible quench rates to about 10 to the sixth or less.
If it's a decrystal, you put it in a nuclear lab, though.
Yeah. Okay, so you can do that as well. And there's other approaches. Yeah, so there are approaches where you can do that, but I'm projecting my bias, okay? And it's one part of the metallic glass community. I know Takeshi works with others.
Yeah, essentially the impact of that is the critical cooling rate of elements of the order of 10 to 10 to 12 Kelvin per second.
Right.
And so, yes, the terms of statement of anything becomes glass is correct, but so it's irrelevant in real life. And it turns out that in binary systems, the critical cooling rate clusters somehow miraculously around 10 to 5, 6 Kelvin per second, which became technologically feasible in 1960s. So by using this technology in 60s and 70s, a lot of binary glasses were formed. So that here, when we talk about stability, it essentially means the binary glasses are stable against what?
Yeah.
And the first unstable system is the solid solution. For instance, if you think about a element, a pure element needs to be cooled by 10 to 10, 10 to 12 Kelvin per second. But if you add second element, to some extent, then the 10 to 10 suddenly becomes at certain composition 10 to 6. And that is the limit of sort of solidity. You know, when the glass becomes solid, crystallized, this solid solution is the first one to come out. So in the first approximation, that the instability of this solid solidity becomes the formation. In fact, that this is that line that
So this is Takeshi's model here, yeah, by the way.
That describes this stability. And to the first degree or zero degree, maybe, it does agree with this binary glasses. And now, that is all for 10 to the fifth or 10 to the sixth. Right? But now we can, today, there are glasses which are stable down to 1 Kelvin per second or even less.
Yeah.
And they are not binary glasses. They are ternary and they're much more complex glasses, and where the competing phase is not the solid solution, but a very complex crystalline phase. So that's why, and crystalline, very complex crystalline phases are slow to grow. So that limits the competing rate.
Yeah, so if I could try to answer this just a little bit differently, the goal and the question I'm asking is to understand the unusual stability of many metallic glasses. And so we want to understand the most stable glasses, not any glass that you could make if you quenched it fast enough. And so as Takeshi said, as you start to add more and more elements, some of the glasses are remarkably stable. I think the lowest critical cooling rate is 0.07 K per second. So it's almost like a silicate glass. And so we would like to understand what's different about those. Even in the binary glasses, as we did this this review, there are 6 binary bulk metallic glasses. You can make them a millimeter thick or thicker. Why can you make those bulk, and why did the others have to have quench rates of 10 to the 6? Well, what's different about them? And so we'd like to understand those critical features that separate some of the glasses as unusually stable relative to the other.
So from principally, if one would give you, so you have the potential, then somebody gives you the phase diagram plus the relaxation time, the viscosity at each state point, then basically, experimentally, you can say these are glass forms or not, and then you want to understand microscopically why is it like this?
Yes.
Is this a
question? Yes, yes.
But in the spirit of what do we want, so here's one thing that I would really like. Imagine that I have a description of the interatomic interactions. I would like to know, will it form a glass or will it not form a glass? And there's just such a huge discrepancy in cooling rates by simulation compared with experimental cooling rates that I don't feel that we have a viable means through simulation to distinguish what model is a class 1 model.
But you're cheating because you saw my last view graphs.
okay.
Yeah, so.
Yes.
The answer is well, right? On your computer.
Yes. So will it be one of the good glass farmers that we're looking for?
Yeah, and so just to jump ahead, I'm going to list what I think are some of the key issues that need to be addressed, and this is one of them. It's real easy to make a metallic glass on your computer. The question is, how do you distinguish between one that really is good in the lab and one that isn't? So we'll get there in a minute. I did want to say just a little bit about, again, relative contributions to stability in terms of size and chemistry. And I'll use a couple of examples here. This is a rather complex glass, a lot of different elements. This is sort of a pseudo section through a complex phase space where the zirconium, aluminum, and 2.5% copper are held constant. And then cobalt, nickel, and copper are varied over compositional ranges as shown here. Now, the sum of this is all at 25%, and so from a topological perspective, if you're looking at the relative size and the relative number of atoms, every single glass on this is topologically the same. And it's the same because cobalt, nickel, and copper all have essentially the same same atomic size. And yet, if you look at the stability, which is indicated here by the difference between the glass transition temperature and the crystallization temperature, so-called delta T sub X, you see that in some cases there's a very large separation between TG and TX, which represents a very stable glass. So you can have undercoolings of over 100 degrees Kelvin. In other cases, it's much less stable. And so if the topology is all the same, then the community is projects the idea that there must be some chemical contribution by the relative mixtures of these three elements that gives rise to a higher stability here than elsewhere. And there, it may be something else. It might not be chemistry at all, but this is nevertheless the way that the community currently sort of used this. I'll give you another example. If you look at nickel phosphorus glasses or cobalt phosphorus glasses.
Sorry, on this kind of issue, in terms of sort of the practical experimental science of making glasses at this stage, are computer simulation studies or modeling necessary? It's not anymore.
Takeshi shaking his head no, and I would say, moderate that just a little bit. I think they provide some guidance, but ultimately it's trial and error. It's extensive.
But this has been going on for some time already, and lots of things have been tried, and somebody at an earlier point in the workshop mentioned some horrible number of how many different compositions can be tried out in a day.
Yeah, that, I made that comment. So a grad student can turn out, I think it's 1,000 alloys in a year. Or no, I'm sorry, 4,000 alloys in a year, and it takes, I think the rule of thumb in the community is 1,000 alloys, and you'll find one bulk.
Yeah. So I think what would be nice as part of this discussion is if you're going to be doing computer simulations either with ab initio potentials or with some useful empirical potentials, what is it needed for? It's obviously not for searching best compositions. Right? So what do we need it for? I think this is something that's worth discussing.
Well, so I'm not sure why you say we don't need it for searching. I mean, searching is still important, but that's only one part of it. The other part is that you would like to, once you have a glass, in material science, we often try to improve the properties of a material by changing its composition. So once you have a glass, so for example, the Met glass alloys were chosen for their magnetic properties. You would like to be able to maybe change the properties. You want to increase the saturation magnetization or decrease the hysteresis losses. Well, how do you do that? You can do it by only two ways, by changing the way you process it or changing its composition. But the problem with metallic glasses is as soon as you start to change the composition, you change the glass forming ability. And the alloys that you have to try, it's sort of a boundary problem. So if simulation could give you some guidance in that, that would be of an immense help.
I don't understand this statement that, I mean, I feel like I'm hearing two contradictory things and everybody's nodding their head here. So, I mean, I thought the statement that they can do what, test 1,000 glasses a year and they find one that's any good. And they find it very hard to optimize. I mean, there are maybe one or two groups in the world.
That's right.
Yeah.
I thought there was an argument that we need the computer simulations to help with the optimization or selecting the compositions. But then there's a big nodding, so I'd like to understand why.
So why are you saying no, Conrad?
Well, you don't have to know. You see the composition there, and some other composition in the Johnson's lab, the Inouye's lab, which are, I think, the two leading groups who actually introduced new glasses. In Charlotte, also the group from, what's his name? Anyway, the iron glasses. What they're doing is actually adding a percent, half a percent, a tenth of a percent to it. And we didn't mention it then up to now, but the properties of these glasses change. If we add 1% of phosphorus to the system, or 1% of any kind, okay, they can crystallize earlier, they can be more magnetic, softer, they can have different diffusion constants. We know it from the interscalar measurements. Herbert Schober also did some simulation about that. So we don't need the MD simulation to look for new glasses. You cannot probably hope get all the potentials right, any of the electronic contributions right, to have a change of 1% makes a good or a bad glass. That's what it is.
No, you have to be careful. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't.
Well, in those competitions we are talking about, that's what it is right now, okay? No, we want to make it, we know we can make easy glasses, okay, for a wide, broad range. To make tough glasses, to make high magnetic...
But Conrad, if you look at something like this, you can change things 5, 10, 15, 20% and still have a similar glass.
I don't argue about that. I'm arguing that you cannot, what Michael is saying, you cannot get any help from computer simulation to find the right composition for a glass with a different composition property here. But what you need, and then I think we agreed on that already previously, what you need is to understand diffusion, to understand viscous flow, to understand the mechanical elastic properties. We have no blood system to look at the atoms, okay? So we have to go back to the MD simulation and see what can be identified as objects as we discussed the other day. That is, to my opinion, why we need to do a lot of MD right now. It's not to find new glasses.
But you're saying that, so I'm not understanding the reason. So you're saying the reason why is because it's impossible. It's not a worthy goal.
Well, look at the composition.
That sounds like a leading question.
let me explain something.
Yes, okay.
First of all, MD can never compete because, again, we all agree that the rate is completely different, right? That we're talking about,
we're talking about theory in general,
right?
We have no theoretical.
Now, let me make a comment about this group, Masmoto group and the Bill Johnson's group. Masmoto group is huge, it's like always at least 50 people, and Caltech is much smaller,
yes.
Maybe 4 or 5, something like that, right?
Yes.
And then they are able to compete. I'm not saying that that's because they are smart.
I'm not calling now, okay? Please turn off the mic.
Yeah. Actually, it is being recorded.
Okay. It's not Matsumoto's group, it's Inouye's group.
Yeah, let me finish. The difference is that they used this huge number of people and studied so many, many millions, not millions, but thousands, maybe tens of thousands of alloys to develop new class. They did discover new class of group of alloys. Then Bill Johnson was very smart, he picked up one group and added a few from beryllium, which is a nice idea, but kind of obvious. And then improve this great.
I'm not debating it.
It's a huge, important, very, very important, gigantic effort. Both of them important. I'm saying that it took that much of an effort to produce unexpected new class of others. And the MD and theory, we cannot we never can.
But they did it, but I mean, if it's important, yeah, and it requires a lot of thinking and looking at a lot of different alloy classes, but it can't be systematized into a theory? I don't understand.
Well, yeah, no, that's different. That's post-mortem, okay?
Right.
Once it is done, yes, we study, and you know, it's a science, so we try to understand. That's all I do, too.
I don't understand.
No. So let's follow up on a specific thing, like phosphorus. You say it would be very hard to figure out why such a small percentage would do something, but I would think phosphorus is just the kind of thing that would do something,
yes,
because
yeah,
it's not a spherically symmetric metal,
yes, exactly,
atom, and so that you could, with simulations, ask, what happens if I put in a little more directionally bonded things that sever connections? Right?
Actually, Mike's done some of that work. You've published that in the last few years with the UVA group. So some of the.
I think the point, maybe we should make this clarification here. I think when you talk about what you could do with computation, right? One could be, as in sort of other contexts people claim to, which is try and do sort of computational materials design, right? So I guess what is being said is that computational materials design for finding good metallic glass composition is not going to happen anytime soon, right? So that's very different from using computer simulations to develop. So the fact that you have to try thousands and thousands of combinations,
yes,
means that in fact there are no very strong guiding principles, right, which are sufficiently powerful. There are some. And either, you know, like, so the possibility is either that in fact there aren't going to be any, or they haven't been discovered. Right. So if there are sort of general principles to have and they haven't been discovered, there presumably is a niche for theory and computer simulations. And focusing on that niche, we should ask what kind of modeling,
yeah,
we should be engaging in.
So let me say a little bit more to follow up on that. As much as 5 or 10 years ago, there were 3 golden rules that you could follow if you wanted to make a new glass. These are known as Inouye's rules, but actually they preceded his work by some years as well. So the rule number one, the relative size between the atoms has to be 12% or greater. So this is sort of like the anti-Hume Rothery rule. Rule number two, there needs to be a negative enthalpy of mixing, negative heat of mixing between the elements. Okay, well, for alloys in general, that's going to be met. And rule number three is you need 3 or more elements. So those were the 3 rules, and they always hold those up. But the thing is, they're very nonspecific. Almost anything you try is going
to
meet those 3 rules.
And the last one is false. Yes.
But in the last and the last one is false. That's right. But in the last few years, I'll tell you a story offline sometime about that.
Deepute,
okay, so now there are other rules as well, but in the last few years there have been more specific rules, and again I'll talk about those on next week, that have come out that have helped to give more specific guidelines to make things a little bit better. We're still a long way away from being able to understand, to have a theory where we can understand why one type of glass is relatively stable and another glass with exactly the same topology is not. We're a long way away from that. And so the simulations may be able to help unlock some of those clues.
Yeah, but see, I mean, but the point is, it won't happen if the complexity of studying each particular system, let's say, is so huge that you can't answer all.
I think the two approaches that go hand in hand. And so Mike talked about the first approach, where you look in great detail, using these realistic potentials, and the approach I'm talking about here would be, it covers a lot more ground, but you lose some degree of rigor, but you can find trends that you might miss if you have to spend, you know, 2 graduate students to do one system. So they're complementary approaches, I think. Okay, so let's talk just a little bit about potentials, and I'll talk about 2 things, sizes and energy. So there are a lot of pseudopotentials out there, by the way, and I think the folks in this room know that better than most other people. And so one of the questions is, what would be appropriate for metallic glasses? I'm going to say what I just learned a few days ago, and maybe this is wrong, but in terms of additive sizes, if we have sigma is the atomic size, and so if we have one element A and one element B, then the interatomic separation for AA contact may be sigma AA, and for sigma BB here. And if it was an additive potential, then the minimum in the sigma AB potential would be at the arithmetic mean of those two, as I show here. And there's, of course, good physical basis for expecting that to be true. And in a lot of metal alloys, you find something like that is generally true. However, it's typically not true. And in fact, especially if you have a negative heat of mixing, you find that the interatomic separation is actually less than the arithmetic mean. And there are lots of reasons that people offer for that. You get some small degree of covalency, and you lose some of the electron gas to localized electrons. However you want to look at it, it's experimentally observed. And by the way, I'm talking about observations in crystalline materials, now ordered intermetallic compounds. Looking through, I've looked through hundreds and hundreds, and I would say that a typical bond shortening is on the order of 5 to 15%. So additive in the sense that it's exactly the geometric mean is probably not a bad place to start. If you have a value that's a little bit smaller than that, that would be okay as well. But there are as well potentials that are used and used quite commonly where the separations are highly non-additive. And so so one of the things I would, not to offer an answer, but just to propose as something we're thinking about is when atomic potentials are being developed, I think some significant thought needs to go into how you would select these and what exactly you're trying to mimic.
Can I interrupt? Sure. I just wanted to ask Walter.
Treat someone else wants to ask.
Yeah. Okay. As long as we're on this subject, I thought I would have an opportunity to ask Walter. In the Cobb-Anderson potential, AB double prime, you know, your AB potential, AB distance is smaller than either the AA and BB. And I was just wondering the origin. Why? Why was that the choice made?
For small, for the record, I did a slight modification of the Stillinger potential.
Yeah, and this is exactly what Stillinger had.
The phosphate, and so they did the crystalline structure, and it was a good class former, and so now you ask Dan, why is it a good class former, and just gave you the answer.
So it was chosen particularly to make it a better class former.
If I can answer for Walter as well, so it is true that it's known as the Cobb-Anderson potential, but it was the Stillinger-Weber potential. But what they were modeling the nickel phosphorus system at the time they produced their potential, the glass nickel 80 phosphorus 20 was one of the best glasses known. Now it's not very good at all because we've done so much better. But if you look at the structure, and by the way, at the time the Stillinger and Weber did their potential, there were partial pair distribution functions available to define this structure factor, and you found that the partial coordination number for phosphorus-phosphorus was zero. There were no phosphorus-phosphorus contacts in this glass. And the way we would model that structure now is that each phosphorus atom is surrounded by nickel atoms, and then the next phosphorus-centered cluster would be like, so you get this grouping of clusters. And so the separation that they chose was to mimic the actual phosphorus-phosphorus separation that was experimentally measured in nickel-phosphorus glasses at the time. So this is, it's okay. If you want to model nickel-phosphorus glasses using this potential, it does a very good job. However, if you now want to model nickel-phosphorus glasses at 50-50, it's a bad potential because what happens now, the reason that you don't have phosphorus-phosphorus contact is a topological constraint. You only have 20% phosphorus, and since the nickel-phosphorus bond is stronger than the phosphorus-phosphorus bond, then phosphorus will always surround itself by nickel. When you have 50% phosphorus, you can't do that anymore, so you're going to start to get some phosphorus-phosphorus nearest neighbor contact. But now when you have that potential, now you have a huge penalty to pay because you're on the repulsive part of the potential.
So
So what do you explain?
Is that a fair way?
Reasonable, but is that something that your reconstruction of how they must have gone about it?
Well, I mean, Takeshi has done, I mean, you mean this one? I read Stillinger and Weber's paper, and I read, I mean, that's what they offered as their rationale.
Phosphorus.
So, but again, it's important to think about these things because, for example, the relative size between nickel and phosphorus. Phosphorus has a radius about 80% that of nickel. That's the same relative size for copper zirconium glasses. And a copper zirconium glass, you can get to this composition, and in fact, it's a bulk metallic glass. You can make it 2 millimeters thick. And so using a potential like this would probably be inappropriate over the full range of binary glasses as a function of relative size, and so you need to think carefully about that. And I think it's fair to say a lot of people who use the potential don't think about it in this much detail, and I think they apply it in systems where it's probably not appropriate.
So I'm actually confused about that there. Is what he just described to say that the appropriate potential for simulating that was just two different materials changes not based on what atoms you have, but what proportion of them you have?
So what I would argue is, I would never use this. I think they were trying to choose a good potential for what they knew at the time for one specific glass. What we know now, we have a better general picture of what glasses look like, and I wouldn't have chosen this. I would have had sigma AB somewhere in the middle here. But now you have to vary the relative depths of the potentials. And actually, it's not very hard, because if this bond energy is more negative than this or this, then that will ensure that at low solute concentrations, the phosphorus is already always surrounded by nickel. But if you go to higher phosphorus content, you don't pay a large energy penalty. In fact, what you'll find is that you still actually get a reduction in energy even after you do this. So I would say, your concern is probably not founded. I think if you choose your atomic potential differently to begin with, you don't have to worry about changing it so much just by changing the relative.
I would just want to say, from a practical point of view, for somebody who is not terribly interested in material, of course, the most important thing is you make sure it doesn't crystallize or something. And therefore, sometimes to have the best potential, and then it's just a tiny thing, and because of that, it crystallizes.
Yeah.
So it's sometimes better to not be so. And I mean, I think something like Hope-Anderson potential is used normally for general glass properties, and you don't care. I mean, it's nickel phosphorus, and afterwards interpreted as argon or something.
Yeah.
No, but I think in a slightly different context. This comes up in people trying to generate coarse-grained potentials. For example, if you start with the structure factor or some structure information as your starting point, something that's well appreciated is that a large number of different, in fact, qualitatively different sometimes, interaction potentials can give you the same structure. Okay, so it's sort of a badly defined problem in that way, and roughly as Dan described, that's how they went about it. They started with the known structure information, and you try to build a potential that gives that structure, but with one sample, one composition, it can be misleading.
And at this point, I think we know more about the structures, and I think you could still come up with one general potential that does. Well, in fact, he's talking to someone else, but I think Michael has done this, because you've used both the Cobb-Anderson potential and the Wahrnström potential.
Yeah.
And both of them are able to avoid crystallization.
Both of them eventually crystallizes when you simulate the
law. Yeah. But yeah, typical molecular dynamics
crunch. Yeah.
So then the homework on Mike, how long is the list at least now? It's about 20 or so. But yeah, these are embedded atoms. Okay, I do.
I mean, the bigger issue may be that the fact that the Cobb-Anderson has the AB bond length so much smaller than the AA bond length.
Actually, it has the BB so much bigger than it's supposed to be.
Has this non-arithmetic property that gives it different topological It forms different topological structures when you quench it at different rates. That might not be the case if you had a potential that didn't violate additivity
right.
so strong.
Right. Yep. Okay, so same sort of discussion, but now this view graph talks about energies rather than atomic sizes. Everything I know about this I learned yesterday from a discussion with Mike. So one of the approaches that are used is, in terms of the depth of the potential now, is this geometric additivity. And from my very, very limited read through the literature, most people use this sort of approach. And this is an energy-based approach in the physics community. I tend to think of things more from a bulk thermodynamic perspective, where you have energy as a function of atom fraction. And when I say energy, think of this, by the way, as enthalpy. And so thinking of like a regular solution model, the energy of an AA bond, the energy of a BB bond. And if you take the arithmetic mean, that defines an ideal solid solution, or an ideal solution, an ideal regular solution. If epsilon AB is less than the arithmetic mean, then you have a negative deviation from ideal behavior, positive deviation. And it's just my intuition, and it's probably wrong from a number of discussions I've had over the last few weeks. But I ask the question, if the relative magnitudes between AA, epsilon AA, epsilon AB, and epsilon BB may also play some important role in the stability. The way some people do it is they set this equal to zero, and they set this equal to zero, and then they just vary the magnitude of epsilon AB, and maybe that's good enough, but maybe there are some subtleties or maybe some trends that are not so subtle that depend on the relative magnitude of those three terms. And so that's something that I would offer as a question, and maybe we could discuss that now.
You know, these questions are at least a half a century old, right? Because they're all exactly the same questions if you want to calculate the phase diagram or something. That rule gives you a positive heat of mixing. It doesn't give you an ideal solution.
Yes.
Yeah, and like 1% deviations either way can make massive differences.
Yeah.
And it's not independent of breaking the symmetry of the sigma parameters, or has a name in chemistry, like the birthday, Berthollet rules or something.
Could I talk with you later and get some of that information? I'd be interested.
So certainly when it comes to equilibrium phase diagrams and whether something's mixed or not, things are extremely sensitive to that. And then, of course, whether they crystallize or what the crystal structure is, too. So these are all equilibrium thermodynamic
arguments.
Issues,
yeah,
and
yeah.
They're really they're the same issue that's entering in that gigantic field.
Yeah.
And it's a tough business.
Yeah. Well, and then you use another word that's scary to us as well, and that is that a lot of that is based on equilibrium arguments. And, of course, we're talking about systems that are naturally.
That's what Frank Stillinger was doing, in a sense that he was, you know, he was calibrating his energy parameters to reproduce a G of R. I mean, that's an equilibrium thing. And of course, how good that is to predict the diffusion constant or something else is open to question, I suppose.
The square root rule is appropriate for rare cases. Have an argument of parisability to get it. There's no special reason why it would apply to metallic systems.
I'm sorry, you said it's appropriate for
Vanderbilt.
Ah, okay.
Ah.
Yep. But nevertheless, in the few papers that I've read, this is the approach that they use to develop potentials for metallic classes. So maybe that's an inappropriate.
We studied systematically the dependence on this epsilon alpha beta on the mean crystallization time in the Copenhagen system
mm-hmm.
at a given temperature. And as you lower it's very clear, as you lower the depth, it increases a lot. You can extrapolate to when the original Copenhagen should crystallize.
So the time to crystallization increases?
Yeah.
As you make this more negative relative
yes.
to the. And for these, do you have non-zero values?
Yeah, we use the original ones of the.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Right. Okay. I'd be interested in talking.
It's a GHCP from last year.
Sorry. What happens if you lower it? The crystallization time
increases. So you would propose it becomes a more stable glass.
Yeah. So I mean, we used higher values for more shallow wells, and I actually managed to extrapolate to when should the original potential crystallize, and we gave ourselves the patience to do that, and actually by phase
emergence. These were MD simulations. Now, how long did you have to go in your simulation?
Long.
And these are all phase separating systems, or these are all
this phase
negative heat mixing systems, or
So it phase separates.
But actually, it
does something completely different. It makes it really complicated.
But it's a little tricky because if you use the Cobb-Anderson potential. At least from my way of thinking, I would exactly expect phase separation because of that non-additive nature. We can talk more. I mean, we talked about this. It's not an easy discussion, but we could talk about that.
But it's kind of funny that the Wanstrom system, which is additive in the distances, all the same.
And you get the same result there?
No, there you get a phase separation, crystallization, not by phase separation, but into some complicated other structure.
So this actually starts to move into the my last chart, issues for discussion. How do you distinguish between good and poor glasses? You can vary quench rates, total energies, packing fractions. And so you're mentioning that if you hold it a really, really long time, you can wait for crystallization. Is that a plausible effort? Or will that only show you the difference between a glass that's really, really bad and really bad, and the one that's pretty good, you're never going to see crystallization in computational time scales? Is that an issue? I mean, has anyone done work like that?
Well, at least one issue is that you have to simulate it a lot more tau alphas than you usually do. Which you usually do like maybe 100 tau alphas, maybe 1,000. But since you have to have this phase separation, you really have to have time. So the first separation, crystallization, we did 10,000 tau alphas, which was something we did to get good statistics for something completely else. And then,
You saw something else.
That could be actually an issue for the future, maybe for MD. Crystallization is known to be described by this nucleation phenomenon, nucleation rate phenomena, and we heard maybe David Butz in Rome talking about that there is an order of magnitude difference in nucleation rate, actually, between the real experiments, colloidal systems, and versus the ones which you simulate. And we know also from the experiment that crystallization is a real tough issue. It's not really understood. And what we had the old ideas of from thermal going of maybe you can ask Franz Papenmann one of these days how he described it is not true. Okay, it's just not true. It doesn't work like that. Okay, nucleation, critical nucleus size, and then from there on grows. Okay, it's not. There might be some open structures like David Weiss is talking about. Or I think it would be a nice idea if you can talk about that maybe on Friday, I don't know, so we get into this discussion what crystallization actually determines and how it looks like, okay? Because this is really open to experiments, I think also to the simulation. So crystallization is back to the old days where you needed poor glasses and had to worry about crystallization. Now you would like to understand what it actually is, okay?
But is the issue here more that the rate is limited by the diffusion, which is a very different thing than in many of the other cases?
Yeah, but for metallic glasses, since we can't really observe first stages, Ken Kelton is talking about that maybe in the conference here next week. Yeah. It would be nice to see how the simulation, what is predicting there, what is observed there, okay? That would be a nice issue.
All right, yeah.
And then I'd ask the question, are there other approaches that we have?
Well, I don't know. I bet it comes up during the conference next week, because Ken Kelton is coming, Franz is here, Levi is not coming, right?
So you can ask the question, Conrad, next week.
On the table, since at least, some time, we know that the crystallization is very, very different. For example, Lindsay Greer did a nice study some time ago. If you add this 1% of additional atom to additional component to the system, crystallization is totally different. Once you form nanocrystal, it comes from huge microcrystals, okay? That is different. And the crystallization temperature changes dramatically and properly. So there is it's a whole ballgame, isn't it?
No, but at the end of the day, I mean,
I mean, what you can quantify is the relative stabilities of the liquid and crystal phases. Like what I see as being a little bit more of a complicated question is what crystal phase should I be looking at? Right? And I think that's, so it's not so much how nucleation happens, right? I think people will continue to get absolute nucleation rate numbers wrong.
For some yes.
Okay. So I don't think you're going to wait for nucleation theory to be fixed before you start to look at these things. There are some factors which do contribute to nucleation rates, which we know, and those certainly are going to be good guides. They're not going to mislead you, right? But there are discrepancies which, I'm not sure offhand whether how nucleation occurs and how that affects the nucleation rates that I can calculate should be a very important part of, it's an important question by itself, but I'm not sure if it's an important part of this discussion.
So it brings me up because you asked what can MD simulation or simulation help to the glass community. Right. And that yes. is an issue because the glass community, the experimental one, worked on that for years. There's tons of literature about precision. And it's from the fundamental point of view, it's fully understood.
It's fully understood.
Yeah. Lots of results, but fully understood.
Yeah. No, but that's in the general context.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, okay.
Calculation of rates.
Is it good?
That's one approach for looking at different simulations and saying this one is a better glass than that one. You could look at which one crystallizes first over some temperature or time scale. Other approaches that people have used, they've tracked the packing fraction that you get. And now this becomes what I would consider to be a sort of a second order correlation. Some of the structures, as you change the relative size or change the relative bond energies, some glasses will have a higher packing fraction, others will have a lower packing fraction. And you expect that those with a higher packing fraction might be more stable, but my understanding is that that's never really been shown. So that's just sort of an expectation. Total energies, you can calculate.
Excuse me, that we really believe this to be true. I mean, from this point of view, silica should be an extremely bad glass.
Yeah, no,
it's a very good one. So.
I don't expect it to be true. So I'm just asking questions. What could we do?
No, but I mean,
as a simulation.
It's true for a limited class of glass formers, like metallic glasses.
For example, if you choose, these folks didn't do it, but if you take one binary system and just change the composition, the relative numbers of atoms, and then look at the packing fraction across there, maybe it might be more of an appropriate measure to say this composition will be more stable than that composition for this specific binary system. But in a general sense, to compare one system to another system, maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it is another. Maybe people have some experience with that. But my intuition makes me feel a little uncomfortable with using that as your sole criterion for good glasses versus bad glasses.
What's the units?
In this paper, the question is, what's the units of the cooling rate? They were in MD timescales. Maybe somebody can explain that to me. I don't know what it is, but I think, yeah. Yeah, okay, let's see. Yeah, so divide by picoseconds or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
Going back briefly because the nucleation issue, and are there sort of features of nucleation that are special to metallic glasses, which are additional complications to the general understanding of nucleation. For example, I don't know if these questions have been formulated, I'm just ignorant. One thing I can see is that when you have, even in the liquid, when you have a relatively low mobility medium, where, let's say, you are sort of nucleating into a phase which is substantially different in composition from the parent phase, then locally you're actually going to create an environment that's around the crystal, the nucleus that you might form, and you're going to create an environment that is very different from when the pattern fades, right, that you started with. So, and this would, I imagine, inhibit nucleation. Are these kind of questions that people are interested in asking?
No. But it's known also that the diffusion constant of Vinci-Grieg detail study is not affected by a certain concentration of changes. Okay, you're adding something or you change something. And diffusion constants for each component seem to be very similar. But then the crystallization behavior is totally different. So diffusion is one issue, sure. It's very poor, it's very low temperatures and so on, and you can have even the monoatomic system still amorphous, okay, at cryogenic temperatures, because there's no diffusion, they have new rearrangements. But then the diffusion constant at 300 Celsius, where you all crystallize all these metallic glasses, 300, 400 Celsius, and the diffusion constant is pretty high, but still, what kind of nucleus is formed first in which is growing is still a very open question. And there is all kinds of hand rules, polymorphic crystallization versus first the solid solution and the alpha crystallization and so on.
Well, and just to round out this discussion, to be fair, there are two other phenomena, one that's widely observed, and that is phase separation. And so that's not as well understood either. And then the second one is that you asked if there are any unique aspects of nucleation in metallic glasses. There are a small number of glasses that show an unusually high number density of nuclei per cubic meter, 10 to the 21st nuclei per cubic meter. 10 to the 22nd. This is one every million atoms you form a nucleus. Aluminum-based glasses do this, and a couple of other glasses as well. And the crystals are very, very small. They're usually 1 or 2 or 3 nanometers. They seem to be growing into a highly undercooled state because they develop this sort of nodular morphology. But some glasses do that. Most of them don't. And
if you have too much aluminum, you never have truly amorphous state. That's why you have such high nuclear weight.
Okay. Let me just say that's a very nice answer, but it's not. The way I read the literature is there's no clear agreement in the literature, that there are different viewpoints, and you can ask Ken Kelton when he comes here as well. And yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there are many strong opinions, and so that's all I had.
So, can I put that there are people like Peter Haraway that argue that in order to be a good glass form, you need many underlying crystalline phases so that the system does not know where to go, and therefore it does nothing in space amorphous. In a nutshell, I think this is the idea. How do you see this?
So actually, I think Lindsay Greer was the one who first posed that. It was called the confusion principle, and his comment was that when there are so many phases and so many elements, they don't know where to go. Not to be too quippy, but I'll tell you my view on it. My view is that the atoms know exactly what they're doing, and the scientists are confused. I call that the miracle corollary. But yeah, as far as I'm aware, that idea has been tested systematically only once. I think it was a paper between with Lindsay and Ken Kelton, where they looked at I forget exactly how they did. They chose glasses where they changed the number of constituents, and they chose them to vary the compositions and vary the relative sizes. So one there was relatively small dispersion, the other one there was a really big dispersion, and they did this for several different glasses, and they found no correlation at all between the ability to form a glass or the thermal stability of the glass and the confusion of the particular system. So I think it's absolutely true. You can find systems where Peter's arguments will hold up. But in terms of a broadly applicable general underlying principle, I don't think we understand it well enough to really say that that's the way it must be.
There is a book out from Kelton and Lindsay Greer as recently, Theory of Nucleation, so you can read all that.
And in fact, I'll bet you money Ken will be pushing the book. I gave a talk about a month ago at a nucleation conference, and Ken asked me if I could advertise the book for him. So. After 10 years, they're anxious to start selling it.
Okay. Lev Tolstoy said that happy families look all alike, but unhappy families are all different, and maybe this is the case.
Okay. Thank you very much.